Welcome to this talk from the Canando Zen Meditation Center. Located in Mountain View, California, Canando's meditation practice is open to the public. For more information or to get in touch with us, you can visit our website at canando.org. That's K-A-N-N-O-N-D-O.org.
Good evening.
Good evening.
Human life, we live our lives hoping for what we call happiness. And in fact, our country is founded on that principle that we should be free to pursue happiness. So happiness is always something that's on our mind or in the back of our mind, but I think happiness from a spiritual standpoint, from a Buddhist standpoint, is a bit different than the happiness we think about when we consider our everyday life in our modern world, in the culture that we have. I think the contemporary happiness is not quite the same as the happiness of our practice. So when we practice this practice, after a while we come to realize what is happiness and how we have had the wrong idea about happiness for a long time, because happiness in our practice is really about enabling our entire awareness and consciousness to be at rest in its present activity. A very quiet thing. Your awareness is at rest in whatever it is you're doing. And to have an awareness at rest, have consciousness at rest means we are not troubled by the past and or overly reminiscent about the past. And our mind is at the same time not anxious by dreams of some future attainment or some expectations. The mind has let go of the past and the future, and it just rests in the present activity. And when we can have that kind of mind, we can live our life without fear and without anxiety, without stress. This, I think, is happiness. But when we seek for this happiness, we discover it's a little bit elusive, you know. It's not so easy to just have it present itself to us. Even though we may have a consistent practice and we work diligently to keep our awareness present, this kind of happiness doesn't come so easily, because the events of our daily life are always trying to pull our mind one way or the other. Or in other words, we become distracted by the busyness and the speediness of the life we live, especially around here. And even though we practiced Zazen diligently and with determination, we will still make foolish mistakes. It's inevitable. Even though you practice Zazen, you make a mistake. It happens. And by make a mistake, we mean we lose our awareness for a moment. We lose our attention. and we become attached to some memory or to some past experience, or we start thinking about what we might gain in the future. This is distraction. And this is how we will make foolish mistakes. By holding on to things that are not real. If we devote our consciousness to something that happened in the past, it's not real. If we contemplate something that may happen in the future, that too is not real. And that's how we make mistakes. We put our attention on things that are not real. When we notice, after a time when we notice that this is what we do, we let our mind go there, or we let our mind go there, and mind is chasing things that are not real. Out of that experience, we learn that the foolish things we do in our life, our foolishness comes from delusions and attachments. And so, in one of the teachings, in one of the scriptures, I don't know which one it was, but very simply it says, let go delusions, let go attachments, see things as they really are. That sounds good, but we discover it's not so easy. So this practice requires diligence. In the book, Not Always So, a collection of Suzuki Roshi's lectures, in the chapter entitled Resuming Big Mind. In one place he says, when we practice Zazen, it is not that big mind is actually controlling small mind, but simply that when small mind becomes calm, big mind starts its true activity. Most of the time in our everyday life, we are involved in the activity of small mind. That is why we should practice Zazen and be completely involved in resuming big mind. But again, we discover it's not so easy. To have a calm mind when our daily life is so busy. Or even when we're not so busy. Because as we eventually understand and eventually recognize, it is not a simple thing to let go of desires and delusions. Not so simple. So we need to pay attention to any kind of discouragement that may arise and say, no, it's hard, but I'm going to stick with it. When we do enable our mind to let go of its attachments, we learn to practice generosity. Generosity of spirit. You know, not the more than the generosity where we write a check and send it off to some charitable campaign. Generosity of spirit. Where we have a charitable mind. We practice with a charitable mind, and we practice forgiveness. And we practice giving our support to others. in any way that we can. We give our support to others before concerning ourselves about our own needs. When we can practice generosity in that way, it means our mind is letting go of the attachments of life. And we can find our peace of mind. The founder of the Soto sect is Dogen. And he gave many Dharma talks. And his formal Dharma talks are in a big collection. And in one place, Dogen tells the monks a story. He talks about one of the emperor's attendants who became a priest. And so he became a priest already having, you know, a number of material things in the world. And it was discovered that he had a valuable sword that was stolen. And one of his attendants did a search, did an investigation, and he found the sword. He informed his teacher that the thief was another attendant in his retinue. One of his own men stole his sword. So they brought the thief and they brought the sword to the minister, and he surprised everybody by saying that that was not his sword. Return it to that fellow. Everybody was dumbfounded. So he gave the sword to the samurai warrior who had stolen it. And it really was stolen. There was no doubt about it. But he thought about the embarrassment, the shame it would cause the man who took it, and how it would ruin his life. And he also realized that the whole episode really didn't really create any trouble. You know, nobody got hurt. There was no catastrophe. There was no real problem. So in order to save the thief from shame and disgrace, a life of disgrace, he said, "Oh, no, that's not mine. Let him keep it." Well, the minister, because of his actions and because of his attitude, he gained a great deal of respect and loyalty from his followers and from everybody who heard the story. And his family flourished for many generations because he had that kind of mind. I think most people in a situation like that would demand that the sword or the item be returned and the thief be punished. That's the usual thing. That's the usual way people behave. But when we practice and we exercise what we call big mind, we don't feel the need for revenge. We don't feel the need to make things equal, you know, to satisfy some kind of sense of justice. So if we attach too much to a sense of what is right and what is wrong, it can be a big problem. And in this story, Dogen was trying to teach his monks, you don't have to do that. You can act with kindness and compassion and a charitable mind. And that's where you find your happiness. So even though it may be hard to let go of our attachments and our delusions, there are always many opportunities in life to be generous. And we have, when we can have that kind of mind, we will find calmness and we will find satisfaction and we will find our happiness. And it's not a happiness that's based on possessions or attainment or success. It's a happiness based on letting go of such ideas, not attaching too much importance to those things, but just letting our mind be attentive and at rest in the present activity. This talk tonight is a little bit short on purpose because of the... Do we call it a holiday? No, not exactly. But I thought we would make the talk a little bit short and leave some time for questions and answers. So does anybody have a question about this story or anything about this practice? Especially if you're still a little bit new to the practice, you might be wondering about certain things. So this is a chance to just speak up and let's help each other find some answers. Does anybody have a question?
What if the person did it a second time? Would you continue to not say anything? Or like, where is the line? Because I'm not sure. I'm not understanding. Like you're not always... It doesn't feel like you're always doing someone a favor by letting them do things that are not right.
You know, if it happens again, I don't know what the response will be. It depends on the situation, what's going on. But whatever the response will be in the second time, third time, four or five. We don't know how we will respond. It depends on our understanding of where the other person is at. But whatever the response is, we avoid angry feelings, or seek for revenge or punishment. We try to find the most creative way to find the balance. And, you know, in this story, it's like he was making an investment in this other person. He was really saying, you know, I trust you. That's an investment we have to make over and over again. And not just say, well, I tried that once, so forget it. But that doesn't help. And that's when the mind starts to get agitated. So we try to keep our calmness. Second time this happens, third, fourth, fifth, stay calm, see the situation, and respond. This is the... You know, if we approach our life with that kind of orientation, it's how we awaken our wisdom. Because in each situation, the first time and the second time and the third time, we don't know how we will respond. We have to get creative each time. We have to stay focused. So each time we create something new and we learn, each time we get wiser and wiser. If we respond in the standard way, which says, he did something wrong, punish him. We don't learn anything from that. So we practice with the confidence that we will know, we will know how to respond. And this is the... This is our challenge, and this is the beauty of our practice. Thank you for your question.
It sounds to me like what... is this what the message is, that we always see everything in terms of black and white, that this is right, this is wrong, stealing is wrong, you know, doing this is wrong, this is right, and then if it's wrong, we have to act in a certain way. And what the story seems to be telling us is that there's a lot of grayness, and that we need to accept that there are gray situations, that there's unique circumstances. Maybe the samurai had some really difficult battle coming up, or really needed that sword, and so we need to allow for a lot of grayness in a situation. Would that be one of the messages, that it's not just sort of black and white?
So the story is about going beyond judging and going beyond right and wrong, but considering that the thief did something foolish. Really foolish. So how do we respond to foolishness? And foolishness usually arises because somebody is suffering in some way. So responding by judging right or wrong, this is small mind, this is logical mind, this is the mind that follows the rules of the culture. But big mind says, there's something else going on here. It has to do with suffering. This man is taking something that is not his only because he is suffering in some way. And the suffering is causing him to be foolish. What's the best way for me to respond to that? This, I think, is the right way for us to live.
In this story, it seems to me that the minister was really... he found a way to not punish the man, but at the same time, I'm sure in that group, everyone knew that that was his sword. And so that man now had to win back the respect and trust of all of the other people that he worked with. And so in a way, that was the perfect punishment. Not taking away the sword, but letting you keep it and realize that you have done something that went against your group code and, you know, and made people distrust you. So that's kind of how I see that decision. It was just so balanced in a way. instead of making an example of him in a cruel way, he gave him the sword, but he gave him now the task of being more worthy of it.
Yeah, sometimes family members get annoyed at each other, or more than annoyed. The important thing is not to give in to the annoyance, not to define the relationship with the family member based on some kind of irritation or annoyance or anger. To find the connection, the relationship with the family member that's very, very deep and universal. You know, it's like saying, well, this is my uncle or aunt or brother, and I'm annoyed at what they did, but our relationship is beyond those things of everyday life. It goes deeper than that. Let me relate to this person from a place deeper than feeling irritated. I think one of the, maybe the biggest problem we have in the world today is we get so irritated at each other. And more than that. I think it's important that we learn how to relate to each other despite disagreements, feeling hurt, feeling betrayed. We have to let that go and relate to each other at a deeper level. And so hopefully we can develop this kind of mind as we pay attention to ourselves and to our practice. I think what's happened in the last maybe two centuries or something, in the modern world, what's happened in the modern world as we get more and more clever, we have become ready to judge things like right and wrong, we're ready to judge situations. If we live our life with a judging mind, that won't be a satisfying life. Even though we may judge things correctly, most situations, this is not a happy mind, a mind that's ready to judge. But the mind that's ready to be creative in these kinds of situations, that I think is a satisfied mind. So, like we say in this practice, each moment is new, approach each moment as fresh. You know, go back to the beginning, each moment. And decide what to do or how to respond based on what is here and now. Not applying standard judgments. That takes practice. It takes practice because it's not something we're used to doing. And it's so much more convenient to consider, well, if a situation comes up, I will judge it right or wrong, and then I don't have to think about it anymore. You know, we've become very good at solving problems in today's world, technical problems and We spend a lot of time wrestling with small problems and big problems. Practical problems. But when we learn how to resolve problems of the spirit, this is a mind, when we have that kind of mind, it's never troubled. When we practice resolving problems of the spirit or difficulties that come up in the realm of our spirituality, when that's where our emphasis is, there's always a deep satisfaction that we know what we're doing. Sue, Mark?
That's watching the show on NHK, they were showing how the Japanese swords are made, and they fold the metal, and they fold the metal, and they fold the metal, and hit it with a hammer, and it takes 6 months to a year to make one sword. And I was thinking, what if the person has taken this person who had stolen the sword and sent him to that place where they make swords and had him make one? It would have been really interesting to see what would have happened then and how his whole situation would have changed. I'm going to be thinking on that path. Would have changed his whole perception and of how things are created.
No, that's a good point. How we can learn to create something valuable. This is the point of our practice. You know, monks and so their robes, and this takes forever to sew one of these. It's thousands of stitches, and they all have to be lined up to create one of these, and then wear it after you have created it. You have great respect for it. Like you say, just to steal somebody else's sword, there's no value in it. But if you go and you make it, and spend a year making it, folding, then you know it's a true value. So that's what we should do with our life. Learn how to create the things that are valuable. Good point. Thank you.
This talk was brought to you by the Cannondoe Zen Meditation Center in Mountain View, California. For more information or to support this podcast, go to cannondoe.org. That's kannondo.org.